Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's programme, Alan Greenspan served 19 years as Fed chair under four presidents in the US. Now, what is his 100-year legacy? How is Vegas showing signs of the K-shaped economy? And with seven prime ministers in the decade since Brexit, is the UK now ungovernable? You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my explainer this week, yet again, I'm drawing on an element of the SpaceX IPO story, because this week you might have seen the company sought to raise $20 billion in the bond market, and such was the demand, it increased to $25 billion. Specifically, though, these bonds were of investment grade, and I wanted to explain what that means. Now, in simple terms, investment grade debt is when the company or the country that is borrowing the money has a low to moderate risk of not paying that money back, right? So the rating agencies determine this. And in technical terms, that company or country is of investment grade if their credit rating at Moody's is at Baa1 or above, Fitch at BBB+ or above, and at S&P at BBB or above. But if the credit rating is lower than that, then it's called non-investment grade debt or high yield debt, or the more slang term for it is junk. So as you see the news about the SpaceX bond develop, or indeed hear about any other company raising money in this way, you will know your investment grade from your junk. Now, on Monday, former chairman of the American Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, passed away at 100 years old. He ran the Fed from 1987 to 2006 over five terms, becoming the second longest serving Fed chair ever. And while he was praised for leading America through a period of unprecedented growth in the early 2000s, he was blamed for creating the conditions which led to the 2008 global financial crisis. But how will he and how should he be remembered? Joining me now to discuss this is Cliff Taylor, a columnist with the Irish Times. Cliff, there's a lot to talk about in Alan Greenspan's life. He was born on the 6th of March 1926. He enrolled as an undergrad in NYU during the dying days of World War II. He was a committed Republican, although he also served under Bill Clinton. What is your memory, I suppose, or how do you feel that this man's legacy should be remembered?
Well, my memory of him, I guess, having covered economics since the late 1980s, which was the time that he took over at the Federal Reserve Board, was that he was, for those, whatever it was, 18 years, maybe the big name in international economics and finance. I know it's often said that, you know, the markets hang on someone's every word. But in the case of Greenspan, I think that was correct. And it was proved, you know, he coined phrases such as irrational exuberance, which went into the popular lexicon, I suppose you could say. And the 20 years or the 18 and a half years that he was in charge of the Fed were years of, I suppose you could say, almost plenty in the American economy, certainly strong years of growth, inflation generally under control, unemployment falling to a low level. And the various crises that he faced during his term, and this was, I suppose, why the markets had so much time for him, he seemed to be able to navigate them. Often, it must be said, you know, using public money to bail out people that were in trouble, but nonetheless, it kept the show on the road.
Well, but was there too much of that, though, Cliff? Because there is a reference to the Greenspan put, which, for anyone who may not be familiar with the term, a put option is where there's a floor underneath the share price. So the idea there is that, did he perhaps not so much navigate the markets, but manage the markets and also make sure that risky behaviour was rewarded? And if overly risky behaviour took place at any sort of public expense, then financial institutions were looked after, whereas people, on the other hand, may not have been so to the same extent.
Yeah, I mean, that is the criticism, I guess. And there were a number of occasions where institutions were bailed out during his term, and it kept the show on the road, kept markets going up. And I suppose he would argue, and market people would argue, averted disaster because of this idea that Certain things are too big to fail. Nonetheless, when he retired in 2006, he was widely lauded for his time as in charge of the Fed. And I guess it was 2 years later when the markets collapsed in 2008 and questions started to be asked, serious questions then started to be asked about his term in office and the regulatory role of the Fed that really cast a shadow over his legacy, because of course the cost of that 2008 collapse, you know, the bookmarking event of which was the collapse of Lehman Brothers in 2008, was so great on the world economy that I think that has led to his legacy being decidedly mixed.
Well, I thought your own words to describe a part of his legacy this week were particularly direct in the piece that you wrote. When he was subsequently asked about that, he was shocked, he said, that the self-interest of organisations, specifically banks and others, were such that they were not capable and certainly didn't do anything out of the ordinary to protect their own shareholders and their equity in the firms. And you commented on that this week by saying that was hopelessly naive.
Yeah, I mean, this is, the contradiction of Alan Greenspan. Somebody who was so worldly wise, so markets wise, was seen to be a genuine guru in terms of economics, monetary policy, controlling inflation, regulating the markets, was caught out in this way. And I suppose to put it in context, the years that he was in office were years of deregulation in the financial system. They were years, particularly in America, where all the rules and the regulations which governed the financial sector were rolled back. Investment banks in particular were given much greater leeway. Some of the protections that were put in as far back as the crash of the 1930s were in fact rolled back. And this was seen even by Democratic presidents like Bill Clinton as, you know, unleashing the power of the markets and something to be welcomed. But what was going on under the bonnet of this, I suppose, was malpractices taking place, particularly in relation to the market for mortgages to people who had relatively low incomes, called subprime mortgages. A lot of people were given loans which they should never have been given, on terms that they should never have been given them. And in turn, those loans were bundled up and sold to investors who are left holding a pup, if you like, when the market collapsed. So in the final years of Greenspan's term in the Fed, there was this huge risk being built up in the markets. Now, the price was only paid after his term was over, but he was called up before congressional committees and asked in detail about what happened, and did admit that he made a mistake. And I suppose to understand that, you need to understand that Greenspan's whole philosophy was free markets. That was where he came from, if you like. And that was also his blind spot, as it turned out. So he reckoned that bank management, bank boards would ensure that they didn't put themselves at risk by doing things that were too risky. But of course, as we now know, during the financial crisis, that's exactly what happened in the US, and of course exactly what happened in Ireland as well, albeit that the story was slightly different here.
If we could look at the character of the man himself, in my research for our conversation today, there's a couple of things I find particularly interesting about him. One is that he developed a niche for looking at narrow sets of statistics, which led him to recognise the impact of tech on productivity, and where as the economy was growing, the same impact wasn't having the same knock-on effect in inflation. And I think he shares that now with Kevin Warsh's idea all around the impact of AI. He married Joan Mitchell in 1952, and the marriage only lasted a year. He went out with Barbara Walters as well, which I could just imagine the conversations between them. I'd say there would be plenty cut and thrust of it. Then he went on to marry Andrea Mitchell in 1997 at the age of 71, who he remained with. And she indeed was the woman that released a statement about this on Monday. And the other thing about him too is that he seemed to be what they call the Imperial Fed chairmanship, which is that it seemed to be that he would have been a tough man to go up against, disagree with and actually get the message through and influence by. What do you think all of those personal characteristics and more would say about the personal as he flowed into the professional?
Yeah, it's interesting, all right. And that point about productivity and technology is a very interesting one and very opposite in his case. And I suppose he used it as an argument to keep interest rates lower than they would otherwise have been, and was pretty much proven to be correct, more or less, in that diagnosis, perhaps up to the end of his term, when lower rates were criticised for creating and inflating a bit of a bubble. And that is, an argument that's resonating around the markets again today with the whole AI thing in the markets, and Optimus saying, look, the technology gains from AI justify these huge ratings on the markets, and others saying, well, hold on a second, no doubt AI is going to be important, but we're not quite sure what it's going to mean yet. So I think that argument is playing out again now. But you're right, he was one of the first to notice it. I mean, one of the interesting things about him also was that markets are used now to central bankers giving guidance about where interest rates are going to go, so that when things happen, they generally aren't a mistake. But back when Greenspan was in the Fed, he specialized, if you like, in giving out mixed messages and speaking in circuitous language, which had analysts wondering afterwards what he actually meant. Did he actually mean that, you know, interest rates are going to go up? Are they going to go down? They're going to stay where they are. And he deliberately left himself room for maneuver in the way that he spoke. So it was an interesting tactic, and very much different from where he is now, of where central banks are now. And also, I think, was part of this whole myth or reality in some ways, that he was, to use the phrase that was once used in relation to Charlie High, dating back to history, of course, it was una doce, una voce at the Fed, and nobody stood against him. He was very much in charge, and that worked very well for many years, until, of course, the regulatory mess in his later years there, which, so the story goes, he was warned about by some other people there, but he insisted that he was correct.
In the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, he said himself, I was right 70% of the time and wrong 30% of the time. And I'm conscious our conversation hasn't quite reflected that ratio. Would you say that is an accurate response, though? Because, of course, that was a self-reflection.
Yes, very hard to know. It may be a little self-serving. I mean, look, who knows? If any of us are right 60% of the time or 51% of the time, we're probably doing pretty well. So look, it's very hard to put a figure on it. But what we can say is that certainly when he retired, people were lauding him and on all sides of the political divide and in the markets, and saying that, you know, this man has been a guru of the markets and a guru of keeping the American economy going. And maybe the 30%, as he saw it, was the lack of recognition of the risks that were building up under the bonnet. Now, was that 30% of the time? You could argue that. And in terms of the costs that it imposed, those costs have lingered on for many years in the US economy and, of course, in our own economy here. So, you know, whether it was 70-30 or not, I don't know. But a very positive legacy when he was in office, but a really serious question mark that came up after he left that I think has to be taken in the round.
And of course, as well, as you mentioned, that there's a lot of external factors that would have influenced that as well. Thank you very much indeed for joining me today to reflect on that 100 years of a legacy. Cliff Taylor, a columnist with the Irish Times.
Thank you.
This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. Up next, the economics of Vegas. You're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Colleton. And now for my trivia. So I was in a county in Ireland this week, and I'm going to give you three clues to work out which one. The Irish national flag was created by a man from here and flown for the first time in 1848. This county contains the only city in Europe to have both a Roman Catholic and a Protestant cathedral designed and built by the same architect. And the author of Full Tilt, a book from 1965, which detailed an epic journey cycling from Ireland to India, was from this county. Have a think, and I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, traditionally, Las Vegas has been a holiday destination for anyone hoping to win big on the blackjack table, with people on lower and middle incomes flocking in their droves. However, this has all changed recently, with Las Vegas becoming a city for the rich, with exclusive sporting events and a $26 bottle of water highlighting the shift. But what has changed? Joining me now to discuss this is Rachel Louise Ensign, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal who has recently been writing about this topic. First off, Rachel, when we think of Vegas, we think of casinos and gambling and a huge strip full of hotels that you don't see anywhere else in the world. How has the character of Vegas changed over the years, do you think?
I was just in Vegas a few weeks ago. It doesn't seem that different. Like, people are gambling and drinking and smoking cigarettes at 8 a.m. and all that. But if you dig a little bit beneath the surface and look at who is going, it's changed really dramatically just since the pandemic. So, you know, before the pandemic, the majority of visitors were not very well off. Only 28% of visitors lived in households earning $100,000 US or more a year. And last year, 75% of visitors were in that income bracket. So it's now a vacation for an affluent or rich person for the most part. And it's a different kind of vacation. There's a lot of new events going on in the city, new venues for big events, concerts, and things like that. And a lot of people will go spend $300 on a concert ticket and then, you know, go out to dinner and do all the other stuff they can do in town.
It sounds like an example of where the K-shaped economy in the US is now evolving to where a place like Vegas can say, well, look, we're now able to take the top end of the K-shape as the distinct to the bottom. Is that an accurate reading of the situation?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. And that was kind of what motivated us to do this story, actually, because I've been writing about that K-shape, the ascendance of really the top 10% of people in the US who are driving the economy right now for over a year. And this is like a place where you see the K-shape in action.
Now, if we look at the supply side then, because you're speaking there about the demand, who's going, what money they're earning, and of course what they're spending. I looked into hotel occupancy last year, Rachel, and in 2025, yeah, hotel occupancy was 80.3% with $183 on average cost of a hotel room in Vegas. How do those numbers, both of them, the occupancy and the average price, hold up in comparison to previous years?
Well, I don't have the overall figures in front of me right now, but I know overall last year, Vegas saw a pretty big drop in visitors. So it was down 7.5%. And that was a lot of that was because of Canadians not coming as much as they once did. But a lot of that was because of lower income people not coming too. And the question is, can Vegas make money by just having fewer people but who are spending more because they're richer? And I think the answer is probably that some hotels can. Like, when, you know, in our story, you know, we talk about Wynn, which on their earnings calls where they're talking about how great their business is to investors, they pretty much explicitly say that. They say this is a strategy to have lower occupancy but charge higher rates, and it's been really lucrative for us. So Wynn can do that. But I guess the question is, that mid-range or really low-end hotel that has had a drop in occupancy, can they charge a lot more money and keep things going? I don't know.
And when you mentioned about Wynn in your story, you said that they respectively said profit was $87 per room in 2019, and that has gone up to $190 in 2025. I mean, has Wynn changed the quality of the room retrospectively as well in order to be able to command that price? Or is it simply the person who's coming now has more money in their pocket and we're going to take more of it than we used to?
Well, just anecdotally, I've heard the rooms are the same. You know, I think they're like really nice rooms, but I, you know, it seems like they are the same room that they were a few years ago. And the thing that the executive said, which, you know, you hear over and over again in this kind of reporting, is like, this person who, whether they have made a lot of money in the stock market or their salary went up a lot, they're just not very price sensitive. So you can charge them $600 a night for the same hotel room that you charged them $300 a night for a few years ago, and they'll just pay it. Like, maybe they'll be like, oh yeah, that's expensive, but they'll pay for it and just move on.
When we think about price sensitivity, one of the elements that would feed into that would be the quality of the competition. Do you think, Rachel, that Vegas as a destination has competition?
It's a really good question, and it's come up a lot, especially since, you know, it used to be back in the analog days, there weren't as many places to gamble, you know. Now there are other cities in New York that have in New York and across the country that have casinos. And then, of course, like, you can just bet on your phone. You know, I think gambling revenue is still strong for them, but it's definitely a much smaller share of revenue than it once was. Like, the whole town just used to be a gambling business, and now the majority of revenue is from other stuff.
I've been myself to Vegas a couple of times over the years, and I wouldn't gamble a dollar, which is probably giving you an insight into me too, Rachel. But I will say that I think the entertainment value on offer in Vegas is amazing, whether it is the concerts and the shows that you're mentioning, or simply walking in and experiencing the hotels. It is really a different sort of experience. And I think that it can often get a name as only a gambling town. Does Vegas need to rebrand itself then, do you think?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of been rebranded, you know, with the opening of the Sphere. And there's all sorts of concerts there now. I think people are really aware that you can go there and not gamble, just like, you know, just like you do. People are going for a concert. They're going for to eat. You know, they could go and see sports now, whether it's NFL games, football games, American football games, or they're building a new baseball stadium on the Strip that is going to have copious premium seating. So I think people are aware that they can go and not just like sit at the slot machine the whole time.
In preparation for our conversation today, I did actually look into what percentage of revenue in Vegas comes from gambling, and it's now down as far as 26%. So to point out the obvious, 74% of the revenue is coming from elsewhere. And we've spoken about hotel rooms and the entertainment factor, including sports and so on. But can I also ask you about these new fees, or maybe they're always have always been there, these resort fees? What's leading to that, and to the amount that you quoted in your piece of like $45 a night plus tax on top of the accommodation? Where is that coming from? What's that culture arising from?
Yeah, you know, I think that resort fees have been around for a while, but they've gone up pretty significantly recently. And it's a thing that people are complaining about a lot, especially in Vegas. You know, the economics of it are kind of crazy. I was looking, when I was close to publishing this story, I was looking up how much you could get a room for at Circus Circus, which is one of the lower end hotels on the Strip. And, you know, it's the middle of the summer. It's like probably 115 degrees there right now. Last minute hotel room is $8 a night. But
sorry, did I just hear that? Eight, single figure.
Yes, yes. You can get one for $8 for all the talk about how upmarket Vegas is. In the middle of the summer, in the middle of the week, you could get a hotel room for $8. But it's not really $8 because there's a resort fee that's like $45 plus tax, which, you know, overall, that's obviously still a very, very cheap hotel. But I think one of the concerns is like people go and they want this cheap trip that they expected from Vegas, but they're all these fees, whether it's the resort fee, the water, or even like the Starbucks is way more expensive than a normal Starbucks. And then there's parking fees and all that. So I think in recent years, a lot of visitors have gotten like fee fatigue. And of course, the fees are a way for the hotels to make more money without having a high like upfront price.
Picking up on that fee fatigue though, the elimination of Spirit Airways from the American market, do you think that has had an impact as well?
I think it's a really big impact. I know, you know, that there was an analyst who told me about some data that, so I guess before Spirit completely went out of business, it had had to cut a bunch of its Las Vegas flights because it was, you know, trying to like make more money and stay afloat. But, and there's a theory that that was a pretty big factor in that shift last year of lower income people not coming. And now Spirit is totally gone. And it was, I think, the second biggest carrier into Las Vegas. And I had some data that was pulled for me for this story. The flights that they were offering, you just cannot get anything comparable right now. You know, these were like $40 flight. It's like Ryanair, you know, in Europe.
Well, from the perspective of how the K-shaped economy is really making its mark, as well as the increase in hospitality charges and the price insensitivity of, as you say, a certain cohort of American consumers, as well as the decline in Canadian visitors, as well as the impact of Spirit Airlines, you've really taken us on a real trip around the economics of Vegas. Rachel Louise Ensign, reporter from Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for joining me today on Taking Stock. This is Susan Hayes Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, is the UK ungovernable? And what does Andy Burnham need to think about as he knocks on the door of number 10? Now, this week saw the latest instance of dysfunction in the British political system as Keir Starmer resigned as Prime Minister on Monday morning, less than 2 years after winning the British general election with an 85-seat majority. This means that whoever replaces Keir Starmer will be the seventh Prime Minister in 10 years, and we have a fair idea who that's going to be. But why have so many Prime Ministers come and gone, and is Britain now ungovernable? Joining me to discuss this further is Mark Hennessy, the Ireland and Britain editor of the Irish Times. Mark, we are, of course, also this week, I was going to say celebrating, but that's entirely the wrong word, marking the 10th anniversary of the Brexit referendum. What do you think its legacy is internally within the UK?
The legacy is exactly as you described. It's the fact that we are about to embark on our seventh British Prime Minister. That is a direct consequence of Brexit, the way in which it fractured the political system because it produced an outcome that could not be implemented without destroying effectively the UK's economy. They ended up with a botched version of it. So you have people who believe that it was always a stupid idea that was implemented stupidly, to people who believe that it was a brilliant idea that was implemented by people who didn't wish to vindicate the opinions of the majority of British voters. And that sort of chasm is there and shows absolutely no signs, even 10 years on, of changing, because you have a situation where opinion polls in the UK are now saying that a majority would favour Remain. But when you ask them as to what a return to the European Union might look like, you see support falling. So there's no British government, be it one led by Keir Starmer or one led by Andy Burnham, that's actually going to rerun the referendum and put a proposition to the British people. So this issue is going to poison politics for years to come.
But is that the single issue that is underpinning the reason that we have seen Theresa May come and go, that we've seen Boris Johnson come and go? Surely there has to be more than that to it, Mark.
No, there is. But the point is that Brexit is an outcome. You have a situation. Why did people vote for Brexit? A majority or a certain percentage voted because they hated the flag and the anthem and all things EU. But a majority of people who voted for Brexit are perfectly decent people who felt that they had not got a stake in the British economy, that they were angry about being ignored by metropolitan elites, that the economy was leading them to a succession of poorly paid jobs, etc., that they'd no financial hold and place in a way that they would have thought that their parents would have enjoyed in the 70s, 60s and 70s and earlier, no matter what the faults of the British economy were back then. So you had that level of anger, and none of those things have changed. In fact, all of the indicators have got worse. The UK has not had economic growth of any substantial nature since 2008. It's barely come in at a plus, above plus 1%. You compare that with the Irish figure, it's positively anemic. We would not have been able to have done what we've done in public spending terms. And we can argue about the wisdom of many of the choices that we've made in that area, but we have had money to spend. And it's not all just been American corporate taxes. We've had a rise in the in every level of other tax, whereas none of that has happened in the United Kingdom. And you have a situation where you have an aging population, an incredibly unhealthy population as well, which means that they've got more and more pressures on their National Health Service. Now, you can argue that this is happening in all Western countries, that people are living longer and putting more demands on the health service, and all of that is true, but it is particularly acute in Britain. In addition to that, they have a welfare system that has gone out of control. Starmer, for all of the things that he was wrong on, tried to make changes to that, which were deeply unpopular with Labour and probably always undeliverable by a Labour Prime Minister. So you can argue about the political sense of even trying. But nevertheless, he wasn't wrong on the point. And you then have a situation where their disability numbers are completely out of control. They're adding a population the size of Leeds onto their disability roll every year. They have a huge number of young people known as NEETs, not in education, employment or training, who are economically inactive and getting to a point where once they get into their early 20s, it becomes ever more dangerous and ever more likely that they will remain politically inactive or economically inactive. And so you have all of those sort of issues going on. It is an incredibly damaged economy that has major structural issues with low productivity, low economic growth, and none of that changes regardless of who you put in number 10.
And that's where I wanted to go next, because Labour said 2 years ago that this was going to mark a change, and Tony Blair did that when he was romping home to political success at the time. Surely people in Labour would have known what they could have genuinely done and not. So were they setting themselves up to fail by simply saying we're going to change things from how things were run under the Tories, and yet knowing that they couldn't?
Well, if you look back at Starmer preparing for government, he hired Sue Gray, a top British official. She was poached out of the civil service to lead his office, an extremely able individual in so many ways. And the plan, her job was to create the plan. Now, we got into government and there was no plan. Now, you know, Sue Gray knows how to write a plan. So there was obviously things going on within the Labour Party that we haven't seen full sight of, that explained why they were so appallingly prepared for power. Starmer was effectively chosen and supported by people largely because he was dull. He was seen as being, you know, sensible and studious and the kind of fellow you could trust in the wake of the British public's aversion to the years of Johnson and Liz Truss and everything else. You know, they saw him as being your country solicitor who would never let you down. They weren't looking for excitement. They then got a prime minister who wasn't exciting, who couldn't communicate, and he suffered all the predictable problems. So the very things that people saw as a political advantage for him going into office became dead weights around him after he took up office. And there are certain elements of Starmer's character that make one, you know, really surprised that he managed to rise as high as he did within the world of politics, because he doesn't have a political bone in his body. And, you know, one of the things it should teach us is that politics is a craft, and when it is performed well by able people, is a craft that's worthy of being admired. That skill of being able to bring people together to develop policies and to bring them through and to create unity amongst disparate groups who are angry about X, Y, or Z, but getting people to a point where they can agree on something. That is a very considerable skill in life. Starmer had none of that. He wasn't able to talk to his parliamentary party. He wasn't able to talk to the British public at large, and eventually got into a point where, because of what is an incredibly toxic media culture in Britain, and I worked in Westminster for years, where the level of personality politics there is vastly in excess of anything that any of us would have experienced in Leinster House, even though we're not immune to the same sins, and where every political leader has to have an ism attached to their name within 3 or 6 months of being able to take up office. And the reality is we've only had two politicians in Britain over the last 50 years who deserved an ism after their name, and one of them was Margaret Thatcher, and the other was Tony Blair, and the rest of the people have, to a greater or lesser extent, been managers of a system rather than people who had a fundamental vision as how they wanted to change it.
And so, let's just say Andy Burnham goes in, because that's who it clearly looks like is going to be going into number 10. Let's say he goes in and he's better at communication. He's better at bringing people with him. His policy seems to be what has worked in Manchester. Let's scale it up now to across the UK. But it doesn't change the arithmetic of the sheer fact that the UK economy has 100% debt to GDP, as well as all of the other structural problems that you've mentioned there, Mark. So has Andy Burnham any better of a chance than his predecessor?
Well, I mean, the odds are against, but, you know, as always, you wish people the best when they're taking up a new job. The difficulties he's got, he was a cabinet minister during the Brown era, and he was fine. I mean, nobody would put a list of major blunders at his door. Equally, if you were to go and say, well, what were the major achievements? You'd be kind of shy of candidates there. He is said to be somebody who struggles to make decisions, who likes to be popular, all of the kind of things that are serious handicaps.
They're big problems,
in the world.
Mark. They're really big problems.
Yeah, they're problems, not advantages in the world of politics. And he's the second person to occupy number 10, or will be the second person to occupy number 10, who comes from a mayoralty background, and somebody who was seen as being very successful in Manchester. But Boris Johnson was seen as being successful in London. And look at how he performed. The very skills that are valuable at a local level, in terms of representing the place and all the rest of it, are also matched with the fact that you have very few levers of control. And that, so making a comparison between somebody's performance in a mayoralty, even in a city the size of Manchester, and in charge of transport and in charge of a few other things, that's an awful long way from being in charge of everything, or at least being responsible for everything in number 10. Equally, you have a situation where the UK faces huge international challenges. It's got a defence budget. We saw a defence secretary quitting because he couldn't get money to make the changes that he needs. You have a country that is still dealing with the fact that it has never emotionally or any other way accepted the fact that it is no longer a major power. It is at best a mid-European power. And that's not going to change. But you that instinctively has not been understood within the British body politic, or indeed amongst the public at large. There is still this almost instinctive position that it is a world player. It is not. It hasn't been for since before Suez, and it certainly hasn't been in the aftermath of Brexit. Now, on the other hand, there are things that could be done in terms of closer cooperation with Europe on security issues and all of that, which would be extremely valuable for Europe as a whole in terms of presenting a stronger face to Moscow and elsewhere. And that is something that he could lead on if he makes the effort to go and talk to every capital to try and get better value for defence spending. But he has challenges on every front. He's not going to be able to change the face of the Labour government. Okay, you know, Rachel Reeves doesn't seem like she's got a prayer of staying in the Treasury as Chancellor. There'll have to be other changes.
Well, that'll be probably Ed Miliband, really, won't it?
Well, as of now, that's the gossip. But if he does that, then he's bringing a toxic flame onto his government from the very start, because there's large parts of the British right-wing press who hate Ed Miliband today as much as they did 10 years ago. And you know, his leadership of Labour back then was to a not insignificant extent destroyed by the Mail and by some of the other papers. And a lot of the things that Miliband were saying back then were actually proven to be entirely right. He was the one who was talking, you know, 12, 13 years ago about predatory capitalism. So a lot of the kind of things that have become much more current in terms of public opinion, that something has gone wrong, that we're in a world where we have an increasing number of incredibly wealthy people who are able to dictate the fortunes of far too many other people. That's a concept that's understood entirely by the public at large in 26 in the same way that it wasn't back in 2013. And he was roundly mocked for that. But if I can,
Mark, because I'm right up against the clock here, I do just want to go back to Margaret Thatcher, who you mentioned there a moment ago as having an ism beside her in terms of her political ideology. How do you think she would recognise the actions and words of Kemi Badenoch today in the way in which she's leading the Tory party?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that Margaret Thatcher would recognise much of the world in which Kemi Badenoch is having to operate. I think in the last week or so, Badenoch has had actually played a surer hand in the wake of the by-election in Manchester, where she's actually put a gap between the Conservatives and herself and Reform. And so she's been moderately successful in that. The difficulty for her is going into an election 2 years are in 2029, although with Burnham now being a new PM, you can never entirely rule out the fact that somebody might go to the country. Loads of reasons why he won't, but there's one or two reasons why he might. She then has to go into that election and she has to ensure that she is standing after all of this. And if you look at the poll of polls that's done in the UK by Michael Thrasher in the University of Portsmouth, that shows, every poll shows that the Reform will have 300 seats plus in the next House of Commons Parliament. Now, we've seen Reform lose the last couple of by-elections and lose badly, and it raises questions over their ability to survive in that environment. And it's quite possible that Reform would struggle in an environment where they're dealing with by-elections that attract national attention, but they're likely to do far better in a world where there are 650 individual races, none of which are getting the same level of attention at a national level, and quite a number of their people are going to come through the gap. Now, whether it's 300 or a number that's far less than that, whatever House of Commons we're dealing with next time round is going to be fundamentally different to anything that we've seen before. And that poses huge questions for us, because a lot of things that we would never have thought possible could become politically viable in the aftermath. If you look at Reform being leading the next government, there's absolutely no doubt that were that to happen, that support for unification in Northern Ireland will grow significantly. Whether it'll pass the 50% plus threshold or whatever is another question. But that question of unity and a referendum is going to become a much more live issue. And there's always the option and the possibility that Reform on its own might actually do things in terms of the Anglo-Irish relationship that we never thought possible either.
There are so many questions that you've raised, Mark, as a result of the questions that I've respectively put to you. I really appreciate your time today. There's so many dimensions to this conversation and knock-on effects. And as you say, things that we haven't thought possible before may become very, very likely now. Thank you very much indeed for joining me, Mark Hennessy, the Ireland and Britain editor of the Irish Times. Now, for the answer to this week's trivia. So earlier on in the show, I gave you this scenario. I was in a county in Ireland last week and I gave you three clues to work out which one. Here they were. The Irish national flag was created by a man from this county and flown for the first time in 1848. This county contains the only city in Europe to have both a Roman Catholic and a Protestant cathedral designed and built by the same architect. And the author of Full Tilt, a book from 1965, was from this county. The answer is Waterford. Thomas Francis Marr created the Irish flag. John Roberts was the architect of both the Roman Catholic and the Protestant cathedral. And Dervla Murphy wrote Full Tilt, which detailed her cycling journey from Ireland to India. I was in Knockanore visiting my friends Monica and Sean and was reading stories about Grainne Whale with their daughters Hannah and Matilda over the weekend. And that is the inspiration for my trivia this week. And indeed, that is it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan A's Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and maybe even learned something about economics and how it shapes the world around us. A quick reminder, the show is available as a podcast first every Friday morning on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do pop the link into your WhatsApp groups for anybody who might be interested. Taking Stock is also on air here on News Talk every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The series producer of the show is John Fardy, and this week's show was produced by Aoife Breen. Research this week was by Stephen Daunt and Ben Sweeney, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day, and I will talk to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton on News Talk
with Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists, helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.